Hey everyone, I'm Adrian Wojnarowski, host of the Vertical Podcast with Woj. My guest today, Utah Jazz General Manager Dennis Lindsay, one of the front runners for NBA Executive of the Year and architect of the fourth seed in the Western Conference playoff chase. And what you'll hear out of Dennis is something that's pretty rare from an NBA GM, a detailed data-driven window into how the NBA's referees have officiated his team in recent years. As an organization, the Jazz have spent a great deal of time and resources studying the accuracy of officials' calls against the Jazz. And the discrepancy between Utah and the rest of the league at times can be, to say the least, alarming to Lindsay and his organization. We talked about why that might be, how the NBA can address it, and what needs to happen for the league's officiating to become better across the board. We also talked about the impending free agency of Jazz star Gordon Hayward, the hiring and emergence of Quinn Snyder as one of the league's finest coaches, and Lindsay's background working with Greg Popovich and R.C. Buford in San Antonio, and an amazing childhood growing up with his parents in Texas as part of a household that included dozens of abandoned children whom the Lindsays took in. Really enjoyed this visit. So here's my conversation with Utah Jazz General Manager Dennis Lindsay. Here with Dennis Lindsay, the General Manager of the Utah Jazz. Dennis, how are you, man?
Good, thank you.
Dennis, we're here in Portland at the Nike Hoop Summit, a week of practices with the world team, the United States, best high school players in the country. And you and I were in the gym last night, and you're focused on, you know, some prospects who may be in the draft relatively soon, some guys down the road. But at the same time, your team is playing Portland. You're fighting for seeding and postseason. I'm always curious, and I saw Dell Demps sitting near us. His team was in the fourth quarter of a close game, and combination of being on your iPad or looking at your phone in the score, but also scouting. Is there an art to trying to be where you're supposed to be that you flew here to do?
An art. I'd say the most honest way to answer that question is we're probably not doing service to either scouting the Nike Hoop Summit or paying attention to our game. I had my iPad next to me. I knew if I pulled it out that I would do a very poor job of paying attention to some very good prospects on the international team. They've done a great job of pooling talent here. And this is one of the most important scouting events of the year, but it always lines up for whatever reason with the end of the year. And it's a little odd that I'm in Neil's practice facility and I'm watching the score and then watching the fourth quarter in his media lounge. And he's a friend, and you want friends to do well, but yet you want to do even better, right? So it brings up a lot of different emotions. But yeah, from a scouting perspective, when you're checking your phone all the time on the scores, you're not doing a good job of paying attention. So hopefully Richard Smith and Kevin O'Connor and David Fredman and Walt Perrin paid attention, because I didn't.
Dennis, this time of the year, as you guys now are getting prepared for the playoffs and seeding and making sure you have players, combination of being healthy, which you guys have dealt with a lot of injuries this year, and, you know, trying to secure, if you guys can, if it's that fourth seed. This is the first time. Last year you guys fought and went down to the wire to try to get that eighth seed. You didn't get it. But now, as an organization where you are, you're in the playoffs, and now you're gearing up, what changes for a team, like just the mindset and all the things that are on your mind right now, 2 weeks away from playing a game one against somebody?
Right, yeah. So there's a lot of ways to answer that question. I think our most predominant issue, and it's frankly been an issue for the last 2 years, and Quinn's dealt with it very well. We were playoff competitive just in, just out last year, and we didn't have the depth nor experience to withstand the litany of injuries that we had. And this year we obviously added George Hill and Boris Diaw and Joe Johnson, and our players have improved. Gordon and Rudy, really the change in the Utah Jazz has been a credit to how great they've become at their job and how steady and night in, night out they've taken the ball. And so the credit goes to Gordon, Rudy, Quinn, all the players. And so what we're trying to do right now as best we can is get our players healthy for the most important moments to close the regular season and then move into the playoffs. We always felt, and obviously I'm going to lean on San Antonio and Houston a bunch because that's where I came from. So Rudy and Pop and RC and Carol and Jeff mean a lot to me because those are the people that I've worked with in the past. I think, from where I'm coming from and what I believe, I think it's first health, then it's seeding, and then it's rhythm relative to your team. And then you get into nuances like we've had. I was fortunate enough to be with a lot of great coaches, and Rudy and Pop in particular were really of the same mindset as it has to do with how you defend. And so where I come from, you want to be able to defend without fouling. And we think that that travels. We think that if you are able to couple holding down your opponent's effective field goal percentage and couple that with not fouling, you can go on the road and win, whether it be at the end of the regular season to gain a seed or into the playoffs, you know, and trying to win a road playoff game. And when you play that type of defense, Adrian, it also leads into the playoffs, second season, how you're defended, how the officials are going to interpret contact. And for us, that interpretation of contact, especially when we're on offense, is quite unique. We've studied the data a bunch relative to what works in the playoffs. Right. We want to be the last team standing. And so styles of play, primary wings, dominant defensive bigs like we have in Rudy. Obviously, Quinn and I coming from San Antonio, me coming from Houston, where Rudy had a lot of playoff success as well. So, you know, how we are officiated through the course of the regular season, especially the end of the season and into the playoffs, is a material subject as well.
And Dennis, you talk about that and the research that the Jazz have done as an organization over time. And I think and some other teams in the league have touched on this. And this has been a conversation among owners, among general managers, about officiating. It's constant. And the league office and the referees union. And teams have pointed me toward the Jazz in terms of the kind of data you guys have collected. And I think when you were, it seems like when you, as you were building your roster and building with you and Quinn Snyder and the vision of the style of play and what would be important, that you looked at how certain styles were officiated and how then as you went from a lottery team to a team that got close to 500, now as a team approaching 50 wins, has the way you've been officiated changed? Is it based on record? Is it based on style of play? What have you guys found, and what has it taught you about how you have to proceed as a team now?
Yeah, so interesting question. And let me back up from 20,000 feet. And again, to go back to how I've been taught by Carol and RC and management, and, you know, how we study things. And I think the wise teams study everything, every available piece of information. That could be anecdotal intel evidence on a prospect. It could be your shot charts, more empirical data. I think Commissioner Silver has been great. He's a progressive, so he's given us now officiating data to look at. So if you give us something to study, we want to take a look at. And that's the way RC and Carol taught me. And if you don't, it creates a blind spot. And it's been my experience that blind spots get you killed in the competitive basketball business. So I would say this. Yes, we have studied it at great length. We have a very unique style, Adrian. And our fans know this intuitively. Obviously, those within the organization, we can defend. We can defend without fouling. So when we're on defense, we play within the rules, and we're very accurately called. On the other end, offensively, we've bent more towards a really European Spurs type system. Even though our actions can look different, there's some principles that are much the same. And so we want to move bodies, one, and two, we want to pass the basketball. Now, we're not the highest assist team, but we exchange the ball a lot. And it's a little counterintuitive because we're low pace. Like, we're the slowest team in the league at moving into the offense. And really, it's become intentional because we want Derek Favors and Rudy Gobert to touch the ball. If we're going to ask them to defend, we want them to touch it. So when we start moving into the half court a little bit later in the shot clock, we transfer the ball a lot. And that's been one of our arguments. It's been a little bit of a philosophical debate that we've had with the management at the league that in many ways, because we move bodies and we move the ball more than any other team once we enter the half court, it's very difficult to call us on certain angles. So the data does tell us at times when we're grabbed, held, pushed, and pulled, it's about every third or fourth game. If that's not appropriately called, we'll suffer from what we call a high discrepancy game, which we define as four or more missed calls, either in our favor or our opponent's favor.
And missed calls that are defined by the league's own data, not your opinion. Hey, you missed that one.
Yes.
Their own research when you say missed call.
So
right?
This would be all the league's data. Right. We're certainly going to get into disagreements on particular calls
right.
with the graders. It's interesting, and getting back to a little bit of an overriding point, where we've moved, as we studied all this information, we've moved to really where Mark Cuban's at, and meaning that the overall idea that we have more disagreements with the management of the officials than we do with the officials. I personally believe we have the 60 best officials in the world. I'm lucky enough I have a high school son who's a good player, a college son that plays at Baylor University, SC International play. I've talked to Joey Crawford about this at the All-Star mm-hmm. event. I totally agree. We have the best officials in the world. Where our concern comes in is how management chooses to either specifically or in this case not specifically educate the officials on particular data. So the overriding point is if they don't know that there's a systematic issue, then they can't fix it. And a lot of ours is centered around, again, we're accurately called on defense. When we're grabbed, held, pushed, and pulled, especially away from the ball, and it's not called, we suffer from a high discrepancy game. I think over a three-year period, the high discrepancy games were 12 and 72, for example. And for us, you know, and for our fans, there's really two predominant issues that we would like to see, and I think every team, frankly, would like to see, an evenly called game as possible. And look, there's no way a miscalled is a zero-sum game.
Right.
One team's going to win from it, another team's going to lose from it. And there's no way to make that go through an entire game, much less a season, and get every call right. That's not the goal. What the goal is to make sure that there aren't systematic issues, systematic biases. And so, yeah, we've had a few conversations in New York. We've had, to be blunt, you know, very frank conversations in GM meetings. And so I think if you were to sit with every team, they would talk about a call maybe a subplot with an official.
Mm-hmm.
We've backed up and we've got away from we don't want to call after a game, after a call. What we've been is we've tried to be a little bit more systematic. We've tried to use empirical evidence. We've tried to use all the league's data
right.
and just to make our case.
So you say 12 and 72 over the last 3 years. I can't imagine there's any greater among the other 29 teams. Is there any greater?
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know because right now, and this is another predominant issue, to be frank, Adrian, I think the most progressive person in the room is Adam Silver. And I think Byron Spruill is going to really help. I think he's for transparency as well. And it's a little counterintuitive for the Officials Association. I think it protects the Officials Association to show the data. Mm-hmm. One, it shows how good that they are. Mm-hmm. Two, it allows them to see reoccurring issues.
Mm-hmm.
And three, like in any business, you're going to make a mistake, Adrian. I'm going to make a mistake, whether it be hiring a coach or a draft pick or a trade or a free agent signing. And the best way to handle a mistake is own it, right? And so our point with the league on the transparency issue And I think there's no question we're moving in the right directions. The L2M reports, mm-hmm. the officiating reports, more graded events. It's just, for example, if I'm Cleveland, I want to compare LeBron James to Kawhi Leonard mm-hmm. and what kind of whistle.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And we're in San Antonio, we're in Utah, and we want to compare Gordon Hayward to Paul George. And we want to compare ourselves to other low possession teams mm-hmm. and high possession teams want to compare against themselves. And we want to compare ourselves, you know, hey, are we tactically making the right decision by intentionally being low foul? Mm-hmm. Should we take more fouls? Should we take more technicals? And right now the data currently limits us. So, you know, there's been a call, you know, from many teams for the league to just be transparent with all the data.
Like you said, you don't think like the officials have gotten together where the league said, listen, we've got to keep the Jazz down. We don't
want,
right? You don't believe that. You don't think you've tried to understand why? What is it that we can do? Is it on our end? Is it there? What conclusions have you come when you say the discrepancy? Like what? How?
It's a great question. And so I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think I'm very pragmatic in really everything that I do. And so we don't have a subplot with the management at the league. We don't have a subplot. We feel like with one official.
Right.
This is just systematically, how do you get the most accurate and specific information to the referee's hands? Because it's been my experience when there's a point of emphasis or a rule change, they're actually very good at executing it. So for us, it gets down to a style of play choice. We've told a league, we're not going to change, because even in the high discrepancy games, our games can be very good from a win-loss record standpoint. What we want to do is we want to defend, and we want to defend without fouling. We think that travels. We think we can go on the road and win. We want to move the ball. It's how Quinn played. It's how he was taught at Duke. It's how we played in Houston and San Antonio. We believe it's a five-man game. We want to move bodies. We want to cut. We want to flip screens. A lot of what Quinn's doing has an Ettore Messina twist to it. It has a European twist to it, where we actually twist screens. So in many ways, what we're asking is that for the league to catch up with our style of play, because frankly, our fans like how we play. Our mm-hmm. players like that all five guys touch it. Gordon likes it. Rudy likes it. Joe Johnson came because he said, hey, I like how everybody's touching the ball and sharing the ball. So as much as anything, we want to tell our story. And this is one dilemma that, you know, we're having to overcome. But, you know, that's a challenge. And again, all 29 teams or the other 29 teams all have similar deals, style of play, how they're officiated, primary players, how you coach, how you recover. Do you rest players, injuries? You know, we're all dealing with the same dilemmas inside of our own particular context.
Your team is among, you know, it's among the bottom end of the league in terms of technical fouls. Anecdotally, people wouldn't consider you guys a team that's players on the court or, and, you know, in any inordinate amount complaining. There's teams who certainly the data would show they get a lot of texts, they complain a lot. But sometimes, and listen, you talk to players and you talk to coaches, and it's not always frustration. Often it's very strategic. You mentioned Mark Cuban. Mark has been willing to take fines to publicly talk about these things. We reported this earlier this year on the Vertical, in some memorandums from the Players Association about how they viewed Mark and how he went at their officials, the things he says to them, whatever it is. Have you wondered, could any part of this be because you talk about you've had a lot of these conversations with the league, but they've been private. Mm-hmm. Is there part of you as an organization to go, should Quinn go after the refs more? Should
right.
our star players
right.
say more? Should I say more?
Right.
As a GM, do you wonder, does that, because every guys are human out there, do officials or the league office or the supervisors, is there an advantage to being vocal about this versus how you've done it?
It's interesting. And we've had the same internal debate. We had similar debates, you know, and for example, in San Antonio, when Pop was talking about strategy and being a low foul team and then going and facing a very physical team, right? And you take those restraints off? And then you get into decorum on the sideline of your coach, of your players. And I just don't believe there's ever a good reason to lose your competitive poise. I find the best competitors, whether it be boxing or football or basketball, that can keep their sensibilities about them and compete great. For example, Manu Ginobili, who I know is a very important player to you, and you've done some great pieces on him. I admire him as much as anybody, that the way he played, the way he took blows, the way that sometimes guys put him down on the floor hard, got up, stared him at the eye, made his two free throws, went back to the other end, competed, you know, didn't cheap shot, didn't get dirty, didn't curse, but yet, to me, that response, the response of John Stockton with his competitive poise that everybody talks about, you know, Pop talks a lot about John Havlicek and how he competed. I think Gordon Hayward, frankly, you know, the way he plays, he takes a lot of blows. Now, he gets a lot of calls as well, but, you know, you don't see him walking up on officials. And so I think that's going to bode well for Quinn, for Gordon. Rudy's got to channel his competitive poise. He grabbed an official, took a small fine. He was trying to demonstrate. He didn't grab him out of something malicious. And so it's a very interesting point, and I think – it gets back to who you are and what you believe and how you want to compete. And those people that have some emotional IQ, when testosterone and adrenaline are combining in front of 20,000 people and millions of people watching, frankly, is very important. And the other thing that goes with that is owners, star players, coaches, those are usually the dominant figures in the league. And so our ownership group has a way of doing business, and I think we've been able to make a few points and make them in our own way and style. And hopefully over time, you know, our fans, the league itself, will recognize that we're playing hard within the rules. And it's very simple. We just want a fairly officiated game, and a game that's safe. For example, we had two players last year that were hurt on fouls. One with Alec Burks, when he was way up in the air and fouled, and then suffered an ankle and a knee injury. And then we had Derek Favors, who was grabbed and pulled and twisted on a non-call. That made him miss a period of time as well. So I think the first thing is safety, and then that every team would say, and I think the league by and large has done that. They've legislated out Kevin McHale clotheslining Kurt Rambis, right? You don't see punches anymore because guys get thrown out. Guys can't leave the bench. You can't take a guy out on the break. You can't hit someone with the back of your elbow. I think we're definitely moving in the right direction relative to the safety initiatives. And then all teams want a game that they feel is square, you know, that is called square. And so, you know, here we sit today.
What's been your sense of the reaction and the conversations you've had with the league about your particular case? Because, as you know, like every team in the league, now some may not come – with as much empirical evidence as you have, others it's more anecdotal. That guy's out to get me. This ref's been screwing us for you. Whatever it is, like they hear that every day. Has the league office looked at the numbers, looked at the discrepancy that you've outlined and said, we see there's something that we've got to address here? Or do they just say, it's dumb luck? How has the back and forth been with them in terms of
Yeah, we could – it's hard to say with other teams and how they do it. Right. I don't want to say that – we're taking a high moral ground or anything like that. Well, it's interesting. Everybody deals with that differently. I think most of the conversations have been adult. I do think we both appreciate honesty. The league's been very honest, and I think they've appreciated our accuracy of using their data. So it's interesting. You'll have a bad moment. I've had a few bad moments where there's been a very high discrepancy game and I call flipped out and talking about lack of emotional control. And certainly, you know, I can have my moments, but by and large, it's been very good. And I think probably it's hard for me to frame how someone else feels about how you're acting or how other teams are acting. So that's probably a better question for league management.
For people who wouldn't, the average fan's not going to see this data. When you say a high discrepancy game, maybe without even saying who it was or when, what's the greatest or what are among the greatest people might say, okay, is it two or three more calls or five or six calls you miss?
So it's important to know a missed call, again, is an advantage for one team, a disadvantage for the other. Right. So we set that bar at a high discrepancy game at four.
Okay.
You know, so four missed calls create eight incidents of possession, non-possession, points, non-points, right? And then you do the math around it and the expected benefit that you get from a high discrepancy game in your favor or the disadvantage you get. And again, in many of the in the high discrepancy games, we actually have a good overall record. Sometimes it's, you know, a blowout where, you know, then there's – whistles for whatever reason that miss calls and again officials don't want to miss it, and then there's some things that are more systematic, but yeah, when you start getting games 10 11 12 you know, that becomes very significant. You know, I'm not going to get into particulars, but we've had a few games that are higher than that.
You talk about, and I know how the refs feel about this, they do not want more data released. I think there's a lot of teams, organizations like yours, and there's many, they want it all out. Like you said, you might go into free agency and have to, there's lots of factors on comparing two players. You want to look at whether it's in what you're going to pay your own guys or make a decision on a trade. How is this guy officiated versus this guy? This is another, might not be the deciding factor, but it's a factor in, as you're looking around the league, there's lots of reasons to want that information and for everyone to want that information. I've gotten the sense that Adam has been on the side for the most part of more information, more like, and he's got to balance that with the referees who feel, because I think they feel once we give it to the teams, now it's going to find its way into the general public. The information's there that everyone's going to know it eventually, because 30 teams, it's going to be hard to keep it contained within the league. I mean, do you think the movement is headed toward that? Do you think that total, give us everything on every call and we can fix or address issues that are there instead of maybe dealing with, you know, like you said, the theories of that guy's out to get me? Well, actually, the numbers show you that guy really isn't out to get you because he's been, where do you think the league is?
So it's interesting. I think Adam is progressive, and I think just general business practices today in general are more transparent than they were 20 years ago, the NBA included. And so at some level, we're all headed in that direction. And look, the owners got to present their financials to the Players Association, right? To make sure the Players Association, have a degree in confidence of what's being reported, from an accounting standpoint is accurate. And coaches have coaching records and players have their points and rebound steals, field goal percentage, free throw percentage, 3-point percentage. You know, I have a player procurement record relative to the draft and free agency and trade. And so I get it, relative to no one wants to have, very specific information based upon, performance. But the thing that I would say again, relative to that, Woj, is I think it's going to paint a pretty good picture of that we have the best officials in the league. Now, again, our specific issue is how to best use this information to educate them on what's systematically missed. All the official or the officiating data isn't just about the officials themselves. It's about style of play. Hey, are we using Gordon effective in a particular area to get him fouled, or do we need to change strategy or location on the court? So XY coordinates relative with an overlay with officiating data could be very material on how you strategize. Is it going to show who's the most accurate official and who's the least accurate? And, you know, is there going, someone going to have to own that? Absolutely. But instead of getting into rumor and innuendo and conspiracy theory and this official was placed in this game because the league wanted the big mark. We've all heard the arguments, right? Now you can just, you know, study the data relative to, no, that is urban legend, right? I think what it will do is it will paint a very good picture just of how good our officials are. And so it's a little counterintuitive. And I know we're, there are several teams that believe that transparency is the same thing. So I think we're headed in that right direction, but you know, that doesn't need to be a unilateral decision by a team or by the league or by the officials association. I think, as always, there's going to be dilemmas. And are there going to be certain missed calls that have to be owned? Absolutely. But that's already happening.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj, powered by digital media. Find your voice.
Dennis, let me take a minute to tell my listeners about ZipRecruiter.com. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Woj. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Woj, W-O-J. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Woj. Now back to my conversation with Jazz General Manager Dennis Lindsay. We'll talk more about the Jazz and this team, but one thing I've never spoken to you about, and you know, your Texas roots are deep, and you've been in professionally in college. Your whole family's gone to Baylor. It's a legacy. Mm-hmm. Your son Jake was just in the NCAA tournament again with Baylor. I think your dad's a Baylor grad, maybe your grandfather.
My father-in-law is coached at Baylor University, and my wife went. Yeah.
Worked for the Spurs, worked for the Rockets, came up as a high school coach, coached some junior college, I think, outside of there. But growing up in Freeport, Texas, your childhood was pretty unique from probably the other kids you knew. There was something called the Missouri County Youth Center, Youth Home.
Missouri County Youth Home, yeah.
How did that impact your life? How did
It's a neat question. It's actually something that I like to talk about. My upbringing was atypical, Adrian. My parents, who are now both deceased, they were truly great people and angels in many of ways to disadvantaged kids. So Missouri County Youth Home was sponsored by United Way. It's in Oyster Creek, Texas at the time, just outside of Freeport, Texas, which is where I was born. And so for three different stints of my childhood, one when I was a baby and too young to remember, one from second to fourth grade, and one from my sophomore year to my senior year, I grew up in a home. So it was black, white, Hispanic, Asian, usually 10 to 15 disadvantaged youth. So these are youth that were abandoned, neglected, abused. So you can imagine what I saw, and so it was quite unique. In an odd way, it serves me well today. You know, just because when you live with other people that have different faith or different skin color or come from a disadvantaged background, you find yourself a little less judgmental, right? And so it's something that, you know, I get letters from and gifts from kids today that my parents are other house parents. There was, it's a campus of three houses. And so there were three families that became really, really close. The Gibsons, the McReynolds, and the Lindsays. Mm-hmm. And so these house parents, you know, really became one. And there's, you know, 36 to 40 some odd kids on campus. And it was a softball field and a basketball court and a gymnasium and the three houses. And it was quite unique. So, there were times where I was like a selfish teenager, right? Mom, dad, you know, why can't it just be me, you, and Christy, my little mm-hmm. sister that was natural to me. But, I think they knew what they were doing. And again, I'll get a nice letter about someone that, you know, has gone on to have a great life. Every so often I'll get a letter from someone who's been in jail and has had a tough time. But the letters, the gifts, the mementos, I didn't make it back to the last reunion, unfortunately, because it was in the middle of the season. All of those are great memories. So, you know, I had this big extended family that's quite unique.
So you'd move, the family had a home.
Right.
So you said three different stretches. You said one as a baby you didn't remember.
Right.
One second or fourth grade and one in high school. So would your house just stay empty and you'd move on to this campus?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We had our house that Brazoria County is mm-hmm. Clute, Lake Jackson, mm-hmm. Freeport, Oyster Creek, Jones Creek. So with the youth home being in Oyster Creek, that was about 15 minutes away from my house in Clute, Texas, where I went to high school. And so that house would be empty, or I would stay at it as a teenager. And so it was unique. As you could imagine, just imagine your mom cooking for 15 people, cleaning for 15 people. Now we had maids and we had cooks and we had people that helped with the laundry mm-hmm. logistically because yeah. one person couldn't get it done, right? And so the house parents periodically would take a two-week break, like you would imagine that they would need. It would be insufficient. But again, mom was an unbelievable person, and she made every kid there feel like, you know, they were hers.
You know, it's funny. You talk about you as a teenager. You're trying to you're fighting for attention, right? And you
yeah.
were an excellent athlete.
Yeah.
You played multi sports. And how did you learn at that time to? Because a lot of the other kids, I'm sure they needed more. I'm sure many of them needed more individual attention than
yeah.
maybe you did. And what did you learn about yourself?
So
at that
a
age
lot,
like that?
A lot. I'm selfish in one area. My wife tells me constantly with my time. And so I think it goes back to those days that I had to compete for my parents' time. And not that, you know, I wasn't very well parented and loved. It was the exact opposite. So it was really unique, but some of my best qualities have come out of that experience, and some of the issues that I, you know, am challenged with today, one being selfish, with my time, comes out of that experience as well. And it's really unique. And let me share one story with you, and I didn't even know, I wasn't even aware of it, but we all experience this as athletes that play with other athletes of other races or faiths or areas mm-hmm. Or socioeconomic backgrounds. And so we were in middle school, and everybody was talking about this team that we're going to face, and they were an African-American team, and how they were afraid. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, obviously the connotation is because this was an African American team. Mm-hmm. It was a good team. It was a bigger, more physically mature team than us. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, and of course I don't say it because I don't want to embarrass myself as a.